Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting faith with life.
Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. Glad to have you along today. It's going to be a great hour. So appreciate your company. Ted Ross at the controls. Chris is at the phones. We got some copies of our guest book to give away today, and I'm confident you'll want to sign up for the drawing for that, because it is a stimulating reading and hopefully a challenging conversation today as we talk about thriving in Babylon. The subtitle of the book is Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. And for that, we're going to bring in a guest who was on with us here maybe a year or more ago with one of his previous books. We had a good conversation with Larry Osborne about his book, Innovation's Dirty Little Secret. But this isn't about leadership. This is, well, I guess it really is. It's about leadership and how we operate in our faith today. And, of course, here on the broadcast, Connecting Faith, we're all about connecting faith to life. What does that look like? How do we apply biblical principles in daily life situations? Well, we're going to talk culture today with Dr. Larry Osborne, who served as a senior pastor and teaching pastor at North Coast Church. It's an influential church in the U.S., and it's grown from 100 or so back when it started in 1980 to 10,000 or so weekend attendance, multi-site ministry. Larry is a husband, a father, pastor, author, and leadership consultant, and he's authored a number of books, including Sticky Team, Sticky Church, Accidental Pharisees, one of his bestsellers, 10 Dumb Things Smart Christians Believe, Spirituality for the Rest of Us, The Unity Factor, and we are looking forward to connecting on this new book. The title's called Thriving in Babylon, and it has to do with, you know, living in a fast-changing and godless culture, and we can certainly, I think, relate to that. So do we live in fear? Do we live in panic? Where do we go? That's the question. So.
You know, what comes to mind is the recent interview you did, Neil, with the Benham brothers.
Yeah.
I mean, they are examples of standing firm for their faith after being fired from the job they had. And that interview, by the way, at our website, myfaithradio.com. I encourage people to check it out. But they're a real example of this being in a Babylonian culture, so to speak.
We're going to find out and get a fresh perspective on it today. So let's get Larry Osborne on with us. So welcome back to Connecting Faith, Larry. Great to have you on.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
The book, Thriving in Babylon, it presents maybe a different outlook than what, sadly, is probably a common fare in today's Christian culture. And I'm interested maybe just if it's something that, you know, came out of a message series you did or a reaction to something. Tell us a little bit about how you decided to develop this book.
Well, I've often spoken on Daniel. It's one of the things I do when I speak at various situations around the country. It more flowed out of a low-level frustration in the sense that it seemed that the more and more that our culture was becoming like Babylon, the less and less we were responding like Daniel. So I've always had an interest in him and the way he responded to a godless culture, and it seemed it was a time to expand that quite a bit and really dig into how did he respond and why was he able not just to survive but to thrive in one of the most godless environments in human history.
I was just thinking, you know, most of us growing up in Sunday school, we think we know pretty well the story of Daniel. Are we missing some things? Did we get some things wrong?
Yeah, we're missing lots of things. Just think for a second, even most of our image of Daniel in a lion's den, that we see a strapping young guy who's full of faith. And actually, if you read the book of Daniel, towards the end of his life, he's more grandpa in the lion's den than anything else. And what we've done is we kind of turned Daniel into one of two things often, an adventure story for kids or a prophecy manual that we can try to figure out what the future holds. And the real core of Daniel is it's an instruction manual for adults about how to live in a godless culture. All scripture given for instruction, training, occasionally rebuke, and showing us how to live righteously. And we just don't spend enough time seeing that aspect of Daniel.
Can you, maybe just to start, let's paint a little picture of what Babylon maybe was like at the time of Daniel, and will that help us to read this account with new eyes?
Yeah. Actually, Babylon in the Bible is a personification of evil. In the book of Revelation, we're told that when Jesus is about to return, the angels are going to shout out, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon." Well, Babylon as a city won't exist. It has been destroyed, prophesied it would never be rebuilt as a significant city again. So they're looking back throughout all human history and thinking, well, what's the personification of all evil? And it's not Sodom and Gomorrah. It's not Las Vegas. It's not Nazi Germany. It's Babylon. And so in the case of Babylon, you have about as godless as you can get. A demon god was who they worshipped. You have a king who sacked not only Jerusalem, but the temple. He took things from the temple devoted to God, brought them to his temple, and set them up on a kind of a display to show the weakness of Jehovah God. You just can't get much worse than Babylon was.
Well, we can certainly look at our culture today, and it does seem that it's moving in a godless direction and probably faster than it has in years past, maybe even months past. So is that a reason for fear and despair?
Not at all. It's a reason for frustration and disappointment. I mean, as Christians, one of the things I always try to get across is we don't live a Pollyanna life, what we call bad good or evil good. And there's a time and a place to be hurt, frustrated, discouraged. We have Jesus falling on the ground right before the cross, pleading if there's any other way. Paul talks of being discouraged and depressed, but there's always a but for the Christian. And the but is we know the rest of the story. So getting stuck in despair or calculating the future without God in our calculation always leads us to a bad result. And that's one thing Daniel never did. Daniel was very aware that God's in control of who's in control. In fact, he opens his book with that statement.
In fact, that's one of the really the summary, points of the book is that God, the sovereignty of God, and maybe if we more clearly understood that, that might affect how we view the world that we're living in today, right?
Absolutely. I mean, just think with me for a moment about the book of Daniel. It was written, obviously, at the end of his life, looking back. So as he's describing things, he's describing them with the perspective of walking with God for a long time. Just like most of us, we can often see God's fingerprints in the rearview mirror more than we can in the front windshield. So when he decides it's time to write about his life, the opening verses of the book of Daniel tell us this, that in the third year of King Jehoiakim, the Lord gave Nebuchadnezzar victory over Jehoiakim, over the temple, and the Lord gave him devoted things to take back to Babylon. So the kind of the, not just the foundation, but the cornerstone of the entire book of Daniel is God's behind all of this. And that's what we tend to forget today when we fall into despair. We think that maybe God is up there not paying attention, he's forgotten, or things are going in a direction that he's not going to rescue. And so Daniel says, before you know anything about how I responded, what God did, you need to know even in the darkest moment, God was not at all surprised. In fact, God was behind it.
I love the line in the promotional material for the books. Is even in Babylon, God is in control, and for us to hang on to that today would make a big difference. We know enough of the story to know he didn't eat the king's food. His friends didn't get burned in the furnace. He came out of a lion's den without a scratch. So, we assume that he won at all levels, but there were some sacrifices he made, weren't there?
Oh, absolutely. As a young noble, he even as a godly man, he gets caught in the backwash of God's judgment on the nation of Israel. So he's shackled and taken far away to another country where they speak another language and they serve another god. He has his name changed from God is my judge to Baal, Baal's prince, and Baal's a demon god. So it would be like you or I having the name Christian and being a Jesus follower and then having our name changed to honor one of the demon gods of this world. So he was forced to study the occult for 3 years. That's the literature of the Chaldeans is code for astrology and the occult. So there were just tons of things in his life that would be distressing to a god follower. But he knew how to pick his battles and not get caught up in the wrong battles.
You talk about three characteristics that he exhibited, and I thought maybe we could just summarize those now. We'll dive in later after the break. But why did he thrive in Babylon?
Well, the cornerstone of his life was his understanding of the sovereignty of God, and then the outflow of that was he was a man of hope, and he was a man of humility, and he was a man of wisdom. And by hope, I mean he never despaired. He didn't like everything, but he knew God was in control, if he was in control, and how it was going to end. And his humility showed up in respectful relationships with everybody he dealt with, even the most ungodly. And then his wisdom showed up in carefully picking his battles. As you mentioned, there were some things where he drew the line, but as I mentioned when you asked your question about what else, there were a lot of things he didn't draw the line in the sand on that we, I think, naturally would have thought, oh, that's worth fighting over.
We'll talk more about how Daniel thrived in Babylon, how we can thrive in today's culture as well. Some important lessons, some valuable insights, some good conversation just ahead with Larry Osborne, who serves as the senior pastor and teaching pastor at North Coast Church. And he has a Master of Divinity and doctorate degree from Talbot Seminary, author of a number of books, including Accidental Pharisee. And lives in Oceanside, California. Thriving in Babylon is the title of the book. Subtitle, Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. We've got three copies to give away. I encourage you to give us a call, sign up for that. We do the drawing at the end of the hour. It's 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. And if you have a question or comment, you want to join in the conversation, we'd love to have you do that as well. Give us a call and check in with Carissa at 877-933-2484. More about thriving in Babylon coming up in a moment. Not only that little bumper from Chris Tomlin, but in our conversation today with Dr. Larry Osborne, who's pastor of a multi-site megachurch in California, North Coast Church. It's Vista, California. Larry has a passion for leadership, spiritual formation, and discipleship, and is a recognized trainer of leaders and pastors and church planters, and has written some great books, including Accidental Pharisee and Sticky Team, Sticky Church. The one we're referencing, his latest, is called Thriving in Babylon, Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. That's new out from David C. Cook. And Larry, there is one of the things you address early on in the book, is and it's a big question I think we all face, is maybe skeptics even wonder, you know, why does God allow evil to flourish? Why do the bad guys win? Because it certainly seems that we look around society, there's plenty of evidence of that.
Yeah, I think sometimes we forget that we really do live in a fallen world. That was probably easier for the early church when they were illegal and having to run for their lives and all of that. They understood this is a fallen world and our ultimate promises are to come. But for many of us, especially American Christians, there's been such a long run of freedom and lack of persecution and things like that, that we read the fall of Adam and Eve and the consequences of it as kind of a Bible story from long ago and not realize that, no, this is a fallen world still. Corinthians calls Satan the god of this world, and our Lord is still the ultimate god of the universe, but there's this time frame in which bad things really happen to good people. And we sometimes have a hard time getting our hands around that, and always have. In the Old Testament, there's a Psalm 73 by a guy named Asaph who struggled with that same thing. He said, boy, I've followed God, and things aren't working out. And then God had to take him into the tabernacle and say, well, let me show you the destiny. Let me show you how everything ends. And suddenly he stepped back and go, oop, okay, that's different perspective than I was having.
We have a short-term perspective instead of the long-term. I mean, we tend to look down instead of look up, I think, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for instance, every one of us is going to die. We know that intellectually. But whenever that happens, terminal disease or whatever comes in our life, or a tragedy, we turn around and go, God, how could you let that happen? And it's, it happens to everybody. But we forget that. We think, well, but not really me. Ultimately, death, the great enemy, beats us all. But every time Satan shoots us, he ends up shooting himself in the foot, and we end up with a victory.
We get easily, as we talked about, get discouraged with the pushback that comes, the unraveling of society in many ways. Talk about the church. I mean, is the church failing its mission if it doesn't take a strong stand for moral values? And then should we be surprised at the pushback that comes our way?
Yeah, I think the church should always take a tremendously strong stand for values, but it starts with living, not talking about it. And to be honest with you, I think much of what has happened in our American church is because we've not lived up to the standards that we have. We pointed at everybody else. I tell in the book the story of a guy who was really upset because he thought we weren't doing battle with a gay agenda on a strong enough level, and yet he was living with his girlfriend. It's like, excuse me, help me understand this. And that's really what happened to Israel, too. Israel was allowed to be defeated temporarily by Babylon because God's judgment always starts with the household of God. So we should be screaming out Christian values, but we should be screaming them out because we live by them. And then every opportunity we have, we should talk about them. But I do think personally we get it backwards when we try to legislate the very things we're not even living out in our own lives.
Use the word counterfeit to describe, you know, aspects of our North American church, and it, you know, that sort of catches us off guard sometimes, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, the problem with counterfeits or real counterfeits is they're good. They fake you out. I tell a story in Thriving in Babylon about giving Monopoly money at the store. Everybody laughs and nobody's going to arrest me. But a real counterfeit might even get through for a while until somebody catches on. And when the enemy's going to bring out counterfeit faith, he's going to come as a messenger of righteousness, as it talks about in Scripture. He's going to come with half-truth like he did in the Garden of Eden. And everything that's labeled Christian isn't. But we sometimes have a tendency to think, well, all I've got to do is make a nod to God or carry a Christian sign or put something on my bumper sticker and I'm on God's side. And he would say, no, followers of Jesus are followers of Jesus. And those who say they're followers are not necessarily.
And Jesus spoke a lot. You address in the book as well about the idea of pruning and discipline. I mean, those aren't words that we particularly enjoy, but again, it starts with us instead of the society.
Yeah. The pruning and the trials the Lord allows to us as individuals, and we need to also think corporately, the church in America, our local church, our local community, they do a variety of things. One thing they do is they smoke out the counterfeit, because a counterfeit never lasts. But another thing that those trials do is they strengthen us for the real battle ahead. I live near Camp Pendleton, and the Marines don't just take some classes to get trained for battle. They go through some incredibly difficult things that start at boot camp and continue on, because that's what prepares them for the battle. We'd all love to skip that kind of stuff, but there's no athlete that wins a championship without going through Hell Week. That's part of the beginning of the season.
So do we? Can we get to hope before going through the proper training or without suffering? I mean, can we can't skip that step, can we?
Yeah, we can get to a sense of hope, but deep, deep hope and confidence at the end of the day comes through our experiences. That's one of the beauties of walking with the Lord for a long time. You've got a rearview mirror full of experiences where you saw in the darkest moment God actually was there. And the more you go through those kind of things, the more you face a new dark moment. And you not only have intellectual knowledge, but you have heart knowledge that no, God is there. So there's a great sense of hope we can just pick up from the lessons of others and from Scripture and from having faith. But to grow really deep in it, we've got to go through trials, which take it from our head to our heart.
Talking about Thriving in Babylon, it's Larry Osborne's latest book. The subtitle is Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. We've got some copies to give away, and we invite you to sign up for that, for the drawing at 877-93-FAITH. It's 877-933-2484. I was thinking about hope, but also about joy. And, you know, someone would suggest that, well, people who are joyful or happy just don't really know what's going on. So talk about the importance of joy as a believer.
Well, to begin with, joy isn't always that bubbly sense that we use it in the English language. Both the Hebrew and Greek concepts of joy is a much deeper sense. And it starts with really a thankful spirit. I was preaching this week at our church about an attitude of gratitude as a part of the message I was bringing. And at the end of the day, it's a choice whether I look at the water that's in my glass or the air that's in my glass. Or out here in California, there's not much water in it at all. And maybe I've got a glass of California drought, but still at the end of the day, there's some water in it. And as believers, we get this choice. That's why we're commanded to be people that are thankful and giving thanks in all things, because there's something to find to focus on. And when I find the positive and bless the Lord for that, then guess what's going to become a larger part of my life? The joy of gratitude. And when I find the air in my glass and say, wow, how come there's no water there? Well, then I'm going to become a grumbling person. You see it in the children of Israel when they wandered through the wilderness. It wasn't long until they were noticing we don't have leeks and onions. All we've got is this manna stuff. And they somehow forgot about being beaten as slaves and the freedom. So at the end of the day, joy so much flows out of what we choose to focus on.
You talked about that focus in a couple of areas, sort of extremes, myopia or amnesia, you know, spiritual myopia or amnesia. Talk a little bit about those.
Well, myopia comes when I can only see what's right in front of me. Again, it's the children of Israel seeing, oh my gosh, we've got water in front of us, mountains on the sides, and the Egyptians are coming after us, and completely forgetting, which is the amnesia side, completely forgetting what God had done in the past. So when we have a sense of myopia, everything in front of us gets really large. And when we have amnesia, everything that's been done in the past just gets completely forgotten. And both of those will lead us in a sense of despairing faith.
Well, hear more of our conversation today, you'll hear more about a man forced to live in a fast-changing and godless society. He faced fears about the future, concerns for his safety, and discouragement as the world seemed to be falling apart at warp speed. I think, well, that sounds like today, and that's why this book is so timely. Thriving in Babylon is the new book from Larry Osborne. It's called Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture, and we'll dive in more on the other side of this break. Invite you to join in as well. We've got some copies of the book to give away. The number is 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH, or if you want to send us a question online, you can do that. Go to myfaithradio.com and click on the Connecting Faith show page. There's an email link there. We'll talk more with Dr. Larry Osborne, who's a senior pastor, teaching pastor at North Coast Church in Vista, California, joining us today on Connecting Faith. 877-93-FAITH is the phone number. Despite what we see before us, we're talking about it today. You know, one of the challenges is, you know, how do we live in today's culture and live out our faith? Well, getting some good insight thanks to Larry Osborne's latest book. Dr. Larry Osborne is a senior pastor and teaching pastor at North Coast Church. They have an interesting leadership structure, which is a whole other conversation we should have some time. It's an influential church, and Larry does a lot of teaching and training and consulting with pastors and church leaders and church planters. And he's written some wonderful books, including Innovation's Dirty Little Secret and Accidental Pharisees and 10 Dumb Things Smart Christians Believe. And we're talking about his latest, Thriving in Babylon, Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. And we talked a little bit about hope, but there's a couple other key elements as well. And Larry, this really comes down to, doesn't it? It's just as we in the American church today, kind of look at the problems around us. And one of the discussions you have is talking about, you know, sometimes we can end up crying wolf because it just seems like it gets worse day by day. And it really does probably get worse day by day, right? We're not ignoring the reality of the world around us, right?
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question that our culture has become supportive of non-biblical values at a warp speed, if you will, over the last 10 or 15 years. But it's been a progressive thing, and we can't ignore that. As the scriptures say, woe to those who call evil good and good evil. But there's a way to respond that is that natural knee-jerk response of the flesh, and there's a way to respond that's a lot more like a Daniel or even a Joseph in scripture.
Talk about how Daniel dealt with some of those issues, you know, as the evil increased. I mean, he was willing to take a stand, but he also had humility. So help us find the balance there.
One of the things that caused me to consider writing this book and piqued my interest in Daniel years ago was, as I read through it, I often put a lens on and ask a question as I read through Scripture. So one time reading through Daniel, I just asked myself, what was his attitude towards everybody? And I not only saw his hope and his sense that God's in control, but for the first time I saw how respectful he was in every single dealing with everybody. And his humility, you know, we can talk about having humility, but if we act arrogant, we don't have it. Humility washes feet. Humility treats people with respect. And it is amazing to see the humility with which Daniel treated even Nebuchadnezzar, a guy who mocked God and destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. Even when he finally gets to deliver to Nebuchadnezzar that a judgment is coming, he doesn't say, man, I've been praying for this a long time. Thank God. And here's what's going to happen to you. He says, O king, I wish it was anybody but you. So he apparently was so respectful and served Nebuchadnezzar so well that he kept getting promoted. Nobody's ever promoted who's disrespectful or doesn't serve their boss. And that's a thing I think often we miss in today's Christian culture here in America, is the call to be respectful even to God's enemies and to serve. Jesus washed the feet of Judas.
It's always, I guess, the tension. How do we stand up for our beliefs but still respect others? We don't give those beliefs away, right? We still hold on to what we believe.
Yeah, well, let me put it through the lens of what I try to tell our people here at North Coast Church, because it's a great church and we've got great people, but we struggle with sin like everybody else. And there's a sense of almost resentment and frustration that I catch creeping into the people at our church when things don't go the way they want. And you can catch it in the little emails that they send to one another, the links that they send, the way they refer to political figures. It's anything but respectful. It's sarcastic. It's demeaning. At times it jumps to conclusions. It hears a rumor or gossip and spreads it instantly, true or not, because it just assumes the worst. Pretty much everything that's the opposite of 1 Corinthians 13 love. And what I'm always trying to point out to them is we can disagree with a great respect. And sometimes they'll go, yeah, but that's we do that and it's not working. They come back with more poison, et cetera, and we're called to return good for evil. There's just never a time that somebody screams and yells at me that it's my place to scream and yell back. Soft answer turns away wrath.
You know, they also, as you address, taking the long-term view, too, right? I mean, living a life of humility doesn't necessarily bring immediate results, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And God thinks in terms of centuries, in terms of eternity. And we tend to think in terms of a year, 3 years at the most. I love the example of Eastern Europe and China, which under the Iron Curtain were closed off. Christianity was supposedly snuffed out. And yet those are the places of the greatest spiritual hunger right now. And the places that in the short term seem to seem as if they still had an openness, well, they've become nothing more than what I call tourist Christianity. Old cathedrals you go and visit. But faith has kind of died. So God was actually at work in the places that we thought he was losing. He was tilling the ground and setting the stage for a movement of the Spirit, for instance, that you see in China today that's amazing.
which gets us back to God's sovereignty, right? Understanding that in all situations.
Absolutely. So in every situation, again, Daniel's not the only guy. Joseph's another great example. And by the way, so would Paul in the way he treated his jailers. Their respect and their kindness to these people, the Philippian jailer even as an example, those all open the doors to bring Jesus into the situation.
Maybe we can define a little bit, what is humility and what is it not?
Well, humility is certainly not thinking more lowly of yourself. It's an accurate opinion. But at the end of the day, humility means putting the needs and interests of others as more important than our own. That's how Philippians puts it. And so it's a behavior. I worked in retail for a little while. And when I worked in retail, there were some jerk customers. But for my paycheck and for my boss, I still treated them kindly and with respect. And that's what I try to do when I deal with the most godless of the people I have to deal with, people who are trying to shut down our church or don't like our church or are advancing the cause of the enemy. I can still stand up to them, disagree, refuse to go their route, but I can do it in the same way that I was respectful to every customer when all I was doing it for was a boss and a paycheck. My goodness, I can do that for a Lord who died for me.
Let's talk about the wisdom approach. The subtitle of Thriving in Babylon is Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. We've talked hope and humility. Give us a sense of what the wisdom approach is about.
Well, wisdom picks its battles very carefully. You know, it was crystal clear you were not to violate the kosher diet. So in a very respectful way, Daniel asked to get around it. He was told no. In another wise, respectful way, he asked again. He was given a short little test. He passed the test and never had to eat it. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were unwilling to bow down to an idol, but their communications were respectful, and they were willing to be thrown in the furnace, and lo and behold, God had a different plan for them. Same with the lion's den. Daniel didn't suddenly start praying when prayer was forbidden. He'd been doing this for years at an open window towards Jerusalem, so he wasn't about to stop. But he didn't expect the Babylonians to live like godly Jews. He never tried to put that on them. And when they wanted to call him Baal's prince, he goes, I don't really care. Call me anything as long as it's not late to dinner. when they said, you have to study the occult and astrology for 3 years, he said, well, that's fine. I'll sit in the front of the class and graduate number one. And then out of that and his humility and respectfulness, later on he rose to a position where he could tell Nebuchadnezzar, this is a bunch of bunk. Let me tell you about the true God, the God Most High. So there was a combination of his wisdom and humility in carefully picking his battles that kept opening doors later on rather than trying to pound down doors today, if you will. Let me give you a good example in modern day experiences. I remember working in a situation where some of my coworkers, it was just a regular thing to take the Lord's name in vain. Early on as a baby Christian, I tried to clean up their language without realizing that was not their problem. Their problem was they didn't know Jesus. And I've learned to let non-Christians live like non-Christians and then focus on bringing them to Jesus, who, once they're a Jesus follower, he'll clean up the things. But their big problem is who they are with their relationship with God. It's not the stuff they do.
We've had a lot of years of experience sort of focusing on the resistance and withdrawal approach as opposed to the maybe infiltrate and influence. Kind of compare and contrast those.
Yeah. Well, when we withdraw, we become salt in the salt shaker, and it doesn't do a whole lot of good. And again, for me and Daniel, the classic example was sitting in the front row and graduating at the top of his class in astrology and the occult. God didn't forbid studying it. God forbid using it. And he understood that difference. When we infiltrate, we have influence. Daniel led 3 revivals in his lifetime. He would have never led those if he said, I'm going to refuse to serve in the royal court of Nebuchadnezzar. I think sometimes today, let's take politics, that if a committed Christian chose to work in the wrong administration, that man or woman would be attacked as compromising. But that's exactly what Daniel did. And as he served well and rose up, he had influence, and he was able to turn things around. You never turn things around from the outside.
it does still get us back to that tension, though, between being in the world and not of it, right?
I mean,
the Old Testament says, "Come apart and be separate." So, talk about help us maybe work through that, maybe in some tangible ways. How do we work that through?
Well, I think there is a difference between some things in the Old and the New Testament, where the nation of Israel was told to come out and be separate and live separate, but we're told to go into all of the world and to make disciples. The one thing we never do is we never sin. But sometimes we think things that make us uncomfortable or the sin of others is our responsibility. I think of 1 Corinthians 5, where we're told in the church we're to practice some church discipline and separate from self-proclaimed Christians who live a godless life. But at the same time, he says, I don't mean at all to withdraw from the non-Christians in the world, because then you'd have to leave this earth. So we separate sometimes from non-Christians who live like non-Christians, and the Bible actually is saying, no, separate from Christians who live like non-Christians.
Getting some good perspective today from Larry Osborne, who's written an insightful new book called Thriving in Babylon, Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture, helping us to understand and maybe respond to what we call the quote-unquote culture wars. We're going to address another warfare model, the spiritual warfare model, when we come back in just a moment. We have some copies of Larry's book to give away. You're welcome to sign up for those as well at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. Linda checked in from St. Paul's. Just thankful that Dr. Osborne wrote this book and for this topic. It's very much needed, and you know, I agree we'll find out more from Larry Osborne here from North Coast Church, and author of the new book, Thriving in Babylon, coming up in just a moment. Talking to Larry Osborne today, who's a senior pastor and a teaching pastor at North Coast Church. It's a significant church in this country and has grown from when Larry and the team started with just 100-plus group or so, and it's a 10,000 and multi-site campus now. And Larry does a lot of teaching and speaking and training and has written an insightful book called Thriving in Babylon, Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. I'm just thinking that little bumper about showing love. In the book, you're talking about how we can end up making the same mistake as Jonah did. He not only hated the sin of the Ninevites, he hated the Ninevites. And you made a great quote. It says, when our passion for God overrides our compassion for lost people, something has gone terribly wrong. Just react to that a little bit, Larry, because I think we all want to be more passionate to God, for God.
Yeah, once again, it goes back to understanding God's heart, that his ultimate control. Because if I'm not panicked that everything is going to completely fall apart and God is going to lose, then I can step back and not like what someone does, but still have a heart for them, realizing, hey, I lived in darkness for a long period of time in my own life. And so this whole idea of having compassion and yet standing up for truth in a lot of ways goes back to the theology that's between our ears. How big is our God? What is the ultimate outcome of things? And is my assignment to wipe out his enemies, or is my assignment to win over his enemies? And when I get those things aligned, then I'll end up with compassion.
Just thinking that, you know, story of Jonah, what the line that always sticks out to me is, I do well to be angry, right? I mean, he thought he had righteous indignation. I mean, is there a place for righteous anger or for anger?
Yeah, there's a place for anger. Jesus himself was angry, and there's a place for righteous anger. But what strikes me, especially about Jesus, is his anger was always aimed at the religious leaders who kept trying to raise the bar of entry, saying people aren't good enough to come in until they've jumped through all our hoops. We don't find him with anger at the non-believers. We find him reaching out to those people with compassion, certainly telling them to go and sin no more and to come and follow him. But he never seemed to go on a tirade against them. His tirades, appropriately, righteous anger, were at the people who were raising the bar, almost saying, well, you live righteously, and then you might have a chance to come to God. And that's what we can fall into that accidentally. It's part of Accidental Pharisees' book that I wrote, because we can try to make people live righteously and think righteously, and then they become acceptable to God, rather than saying, no, they come to God, and then he begins to change them from the inside out. We get it backwards.
And plus, we always, as you talk about in the book, we always have to keep coming back to ourselves, right? Look at the pruning and the discipline in our own life, right?
Goodness. Yeah. The Bible was written to be a mirror. I'm always reminded of the people here at North Coast. The sermons we preach, the Bible we read, it's intended to be a mirror so we can see what's right and what needs improvement in our own life. But we turn it into binoculars all the time. We pick it up and start looking around at everybody else and see how they measure up and forget what we saw in the mirror.
You address one of the models that we often use, the spiritual warfare model. What are some of the problems or the outcomes with approaching a godless culture in that way?
Yeah, well, we're most definitely in a spiritual battle, and we're told to put on the full armor of God, and that's both as a church and as individuals we're supposed to do that. But the reference that Paul was, the things Paul was referring to, was not the culture wars with the Roman culture at that day. It was the internal war, the battle for their souls. And so when somehow I start using spiritual warfare and I apply it to my culture, what happens is I end up with a warfare mentality, which again, to what I said a moment ago, in warfare, you're trying to wipe out your enemies. And yet, when you take the Great Commission, we're supposed to be winning them over. So warfare is a wonderful model when I realize it's about my soul. It's not a very good model when I start thinking it's about my culture.
Is it enough simply just, I mean, to be faithful in serving the Lord? Say, well, I'll be faithful, but I won't engage. Is that what you're saying?
Not at all. Okay. We've got to engage. In fact, Daniel couldn't have been more engaged. He was involved in government at the highest levels. And we live in a land where we have the right to vote. We have the right to run for offices. We have freedom of speech. We should all use all of those things. But we should use them like Daniel did in the midst of a godless royal court, optimistically with hope, with humility and wisdom to pick his battles. So there's no sense of disengage. Every now and then my message gets twisted that way by somebody who hears that because we don't have the rhetoric of warfare and anger, that what we're doing is just quietly living our life on the side. Nothing could be further from the truth. We've got to engage.
Well, so maybe just as an example, kind of help us work through, if your church was invited to participate in a citywide rally or maybe an evangelistic outreach, or, you know, how do you view those things? I mean, you give the illustration about the Passion of the Christ movie when that came out. And so, you know, help us kind of work through some of those real-life situations.
Yeah, in real life, like at North Coast, we didn't get involved in lots of other things. Where we don't get involved is when the rhetoric gets hot. You know, sometimes you can get a bunch of believers and we can talk us, them, with some really angry, resentful kind of language. And at that point, I would not participate in that. But there's a lot of things where we gather together. I tell the story of the Passion of Christ. We don't jump on those bandwagons. There's always, I call it a crisis de jure and a revival de jure in the Christian community. And the crisis de jure is never the end of Christianity. And the opportunity de jure is never really ushering in the second coming of Jesus. But we sometimes think it is. And so, for instance, when Passion of Christ came out, we didn't try to get everybody to go because that was going to turn America around. But at the same time, we didn't boycott it or tell people not to go. At the end of the day, it was a movie that helped people grasp the severity of all Jesus went through for us. But we just don't jump on bandwagons. And that, I think we sometimes have that tendency to think the opportunity or the crisis, both of them are going to change everything. I'm just old enough in my walk with the Lord to realize, no, they're going to inch things along, but Jesus is going to change everything.
And, I mean, the revival doesn't always come through a formula, right?
Right, yeah. Part of that opportunity de jure is there's always And a church like ours, as large as we are, they always come to us first because they want us to jump aboard. And I'm amazed how many people have these big visions of what they're going to do for God. And what they want is they want a bunch of our time, our energy, and our money. And I look back through history and I go, most of the revivals of God didn't come out of the boardroom of a nonprofit organization, a church, or a parachurch ministry. They came out of the heart of an individual, and God watered that seed, and that plant grew up into a great tree. But there's no dearth of ideas that come my way where people go, oh, if we do this and this, this great thing will happen. And, yeah, maybe.
So we want the church to be, us as believers want to be salt and light. We want to have influence. What does that look like? I guess give us a perspective. Does that mean we win? I guess that.
Yeah, at the strongest level, being salt and light means we go out and we do that in our workplace and in our neighborhoods. The front lines of ministry have always been in the cubicle, have always been in the neighborhood, have always been in the classroom. And as we win people one-on-one, as we create a tilt in their viewpoint of Christians, then the opportunity for the massive movement of God comes. But the massive movement of God usually doesn't come from a PERT chart and a big budget and the latest hot program. Those things are just a dime a dozen. They're a revolving door. So I'm always trying to get our people, instead of thinking so massively, let's think on the micro, smaller level and get out there and one-on-one make a difference. That's what the early church did. I mean, they had house churches. That's all they had because they had no mobility and they were illegal. Both of those things will make your church rather small.
That's true. We're blessed. I'm sure you probably have people that are always pushing you for more or looking for more and end up leaving because you're not you don't have the right kind of volume into your rhetoric.
Yeah, that very much. They think if we don't scream and yell, if we don't do big programs, and I'm always saying no. A glacier at the end of the day does far more than an avalanche. I have a Churchill relative that unfortunately was killed in an avalanche, and 10 or 12 years later, you can't even tell that it was there. So great fury and all of that happens at once, but then it's gone. You go and look at a glacier, it doesn't seem like much is being done, but a Yosemite is being carved out. And when it comes to trying to train our people to make a difference in the world, if I can create more glaciers for Jesus, I'm going to get a lot more done than if I have a lot of avalanches for Jesus.
Good words from Larry Osborne, author of the new book, Thriving in Babylon, Why Hope, Humility, and Wisdom Matter in a Godless Culture. Larry, just got about 30 seconds left. What's your hope for people as they read this? It's an insightful book.
My hope is they'll become more and more like Daniel, and they'll learn that he is a template, a model that we can follow that will help us go far more than surviving, but to actually thrive in the Babylon we're living in.
I encourage you to pick it up. It's from David C. Cook, and we've got a couple of copies that we'll give away as well. If you want to sign up here, we've got a minute or so to do that at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. And Larry, look forward to chatting with you again. We should probably talk about Accidental Pharisees or one of your other books as well, maybe the 10 Dumb Things Smart Christians Believe. I'm kind of interested in knowing did we touch any of those today?
Just a tiny bit.
Okay. Larry Osborne from North Coast Church joining us today on Connecting Faith. Larry, thank you once again, and blessings to you and your ministry.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
If you missed part of today's broadcast or heard it and would like to pass it on to a friend, you can do that. We post our interviews up online after the show on our show page. It's at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. And then click on the Connecting Faith show page. You'll find the podcast archives there. And everything's shareable, so you can pass it on to a friend and hopefully encourage them as well. Thank you for listening to Connecting Faith.